No, but not from the.
That's next meeting.
Okay.
Oh, don't worry about it.
Oh, cool.
Don't worry about it.
So are you learning how to?
Yeah.
Mold and fold.
Wait, actually. All right, let's get going. Welcome to the April 11th, 2011 Landmarks Preservation Commission meeting. First item on the agenda is roll call. Those present are Chair McIntyre, Vice Chair Maddox, Commissioners House, Luce, and York, and ex officio McClintock. Second item on the agenda is consent agenda excusal of absences. I have two call-ins for Commissioner Jensen and Commissioner Eckley. Move approval of excusal of absences. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Meeting minutes to approve. We have meeting minutes from February 22nd and March 14th. Are there any additions or corrections to the meetings? Pardon me, to the meeting minutes? Hearing none, they stand approved as presented. Third item on the agenda is board briefing. Live-work code amendments. Item A, summary of current planning efforts. Ian Muntz, please join us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission. The title is misleading. I'm actually acting division manager, which as
okay.
the city manager explained to me, I need to do everything exactly right in order just to keep that title, let alone
okay.
have any changes made. So
no pressure.
No pressure at all, but if you excuse a little digression, I've told this story before, but I was planning director and city attorney up in Anacortes for 27 some years, and so was involved in a lot of historic preservation projects that I'm very proud to be a part of. But so I have some background in this area, but I took a position as associate planner so I could get away from management. So those of you who have been involved in management can appreciate that why we would want to be a refugee from managing people. And so I was, and then so Peter Huffman called me in and said, I've got some bad news, Ian, and some worse news as part of these layoffs. The bad news is that you're laid off as associate planner. The worst news is you're a division manager. So thank you for letting me share that story. But I am excited to be doing this. It's great to work with Ruben. I'm privileged to be at this meeting this evening. All I'm really going to do is introduce the topic. It's been around before this commission, historic Tacoma, local groups for a long time. How can we make sure we facilitate live-work and work-live in our downtown code? And there's really two parts to that as I see it. One is the land use code, which I'm now responsible for. I think it does provide a lot of flexibility for live-work. We're going to work with this group, Historic Tacoma, and the local architects group, to make sure it's even clearer that you can do both in our, particularly in our downtown zones. We think you can do it now, but we want to make sure there's no question that you can do it. The more challenging piece is working with the building code. And so Charlie Salverson's the division manager there. And after conversations with Ruben and the city manager and Peter Huffman, they're moving ahead with scoping out a code revision that would allow more flexibility for historic buildings in the building code, which I don't think there are big. We're going to find there are big barriers in the zoning code, but if there are, we will act on those this year. As far as the building code, that's a bigger challenge because there you're trying to define, as you know, how much is life safety that we can't vary on, and how much is. I guess it really comes down to acceptable risk. I mean, how far are we going to go in that continuum? Or how major a change of use will trigger those upgrades? And that's a big community, in my opinion, a big community discussion that we will be undertaking this year. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Sharon's been great to work with. She's jabbing me to move faster, so.
I've actually done live work units, and they worked out really well. They were in downtown Seattle. They were required, and they actually were completely filled up first. And just because artist space is so difficult to find, that and craftsman space where you can actually have And at first, the owner that I was working with was really resistant, but once they saw what the potential was, they filled up immediately. They were very happy with them. How are you basing the requirement for live work? Is it purely voluntary, or are you going to prescribe certain parts of town and for specific types of clientele? Because we have parts of town that are mostly warehouses that stand empty that are perfect and could be adopted, where you've got like a loft upstairs and then workspace downstairs.
Right. And we, I mean, in my reading of the code, there are a lot of warehouse locations you can do that today. We just need to be more explicit about that you can do that, so there aren't questions. You know, no, yes, you can. Purpose statement, live work.
Right.
Works in this zone. Here's the parameters it works under. And I think we could identify that right now but we're going to have some outreach and some help with some local folks to help us figure out if there are obstacles, what they are. The second part of the discussion is the building code requirements, which you're obviously familiar with from, and Seattle has some flexibility in their code. And the question is, how much flexibility can and should we put in our code for building code standards? So I see a two-part discussion. I think we're primarily looking at the downtown area as a great place to do live work. All of our policies support it. I mean, there's no question about comprehensive plan policy supporting it. Ruben's pointed out, we've got enough policies, we just need to do something about it.
Are there any other questions or comments from commissioners?
Mark, given that you've done some work like this up in Seattle, can you speak to the building code issue at all about what sorts of things kind of come in there? Or?
Well, I think if I remember right, this has been 5 years, that the way the city of Seattle dealt with it, they dealt with it all as residential space. They didn't try to separate the two spaces, and in fact, they were not separate. And in fact, they prescribed us that they be communicating spaces. So they were more like the traditional loft, and then with, you know, live space on like a mezzanine almost, and then the workspace below, and with a stair communicating between the two spaces, and they treated it all as residential space. Is that the way you read it, or
I'm a neophyte. I'm going to be learning.
Oh, okay.
A lot.
All right. Well, yeah.
But my
experience.
But I'm just here to say we're committed to learning a lot and getting this right.
Yeah, they didn't try to separate it as a B at the storefront level and an R at the residential level. They interpreted the whole thing as an R occupancy.
Okay.
Even though, you know, you had businesses operating, you know, studios operating out of them.
Yeah. Well, that's great.
Where that'll start to come into effect, Marshall, is if you have change of use for the occupancy, change of use, that'll trigger a lot of code upgrades a lot of times. And so I think that's probably the sticky wicket for you guys in that realm, just because going from that B to an R, I think that actually triggers a more risky use, doesn't it?
It does.
Going from B to R. So, I mean, you'd be looking, going from some of these little business occupancies to residential.
There's a natural separate, you know, usually there's a separation.
Triggers a lot of that.
Right, a fire barrier between the two. And in this instance, the way they interpreted it, since it was communicating space, it was all considered R space.
They didn't require you to separate it, but did they
even
consider
the use,
a change
even
of
though
use
the use
from
was
an
different,
old B
they,
space to
right,
a new R space?
Even though the use was different, they all, their way around it, you know, what's actually in the building code was to consider it all as a residential space.
Right, but if it was previously, but that was new construction too.
It was
right?
New construction.
Yeah.
That's right.
And going from an existing structure, existing B occupancy, that if you change it to an R occupancy, that you would trigger those upgrades.
Right.
Because it's a more hazardous, quote unquote, more hazardous.
Unless the residential was accessory and wasn't treated as a change of use.
Yeah, and that's
I mean,
the fine manipulation of the code.
Yeah,
that
you tell
there's
enough expertise on this commission. I'd like to come back once we have some early thoughts.
Yeah, and there's and reading through the historic Tacoma briefing on this, there's mention of like San Francisco has some thresholds where you can back off of that, and we, you know, as a structural engineer, we've seen that, and in all honesty, the city's planning department has been really good about in historic renovations of existing buildings, been really good about working with building owners and designers in being able to find solutions that are feasible and allow projects to move forward still, serve the public.
That's great feedback. It's pretty sharp. Pass that on. Thank you. That's a nice.
One of the better departments in the region.
Thank you. That's great to know. And so, I guess where we're headed towards is ordinance changes. So we'd need enough community support to get City Council, public hearing, City Council action on both the building code adjustments and also the any land use code clarifications. Right. So Ruben said start here, so we're here.
Okay, great.
They take commercial buildings and the zoning codes and building codes and try to mesh them and make residential units. That safety item is a very important issue. And it does, you mentioned acceptable risk, and I think that's a very important definition that needs to be worked out and massaged quite a bit when you're talking about these different structures, because to take it out of context, if you're talking about a highway that has a 55 mile an hour speed limit, that has been determined as the acceptable risk, even though people die on a regular basis on the road at 55. And if you say, well, if it's 25 miles an hour, nobody's going to die, but you have to be reasonable about it too. So talking about massaging those things and making them work together.
I really like the concept of live work. And to tell you, it's no different than the traditional sort of low-rise development, brick development that you used to see, where you'd have the storefront down below and then the residential, hotel above. It's just that separation barrier. And where it gets interesting is when you try to do the live work in manufacturing zones. But those are oftentimes as more successful because the rent is cheaper than, say, downtown.
Right.
Say, instead of doing downtown, if they tried to do, say, Nally Valley in that area where you've got a lot of tilt-up warehouse-type construction, that's where it kind of gets interesting. How do you make that separation?
Do we have any examples of this currently in historic buildings in Tacoma that we know of?
I thought in the, I don't think they're actually considered live work, but the apartments in
the Roberson building.
Yeah, the Roberson building,
which is a new construction. I think that was
was
at least a component of that was designed in.
Right, and I did a building just about four times the size of that, and it faced on a park. So lucky the artists, because all the live work units faced right out onto this beautiful park. So,
is the Merlino building on 6th set up that way?
I don't think so either. I think it's studio space up above.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, you'll have this all worked out next time. Right.
I'll have enough to ask you some good questions.
From a code perspective, though, it almost seems like it deserves its own occupancy category.
Yeah, so like you want to go,
it's not a risk of a full R occupancy.
No, it's like R123. Yeah. Is it a B2? How do you do that?
It almost give it its own occupancy
own
category.
Designation, yeah, exactly.
What we're actually doing is the building official, he's the one who needs to sign off on these things, is grappling with his staff on some of those definitions right now.
Because that change of use is all about the higher occupancy counts and just occupancy levels.
Having people there overnight versus just working there
right.
during the day back to the risk
right.
continuum. I mean, how much earthquake, these are difficult calls, but I guess the conversation is well and truly underway.
Yeah, it's kind of an occupant hour per square foot kind of mentality.
Well, the safety factor is not in the B, it's in the R.
Right.
Right, yeah.
Right.
So, this is a conversation that's kind of had fits and starts over the years here in Tacoma. We've gotten a lot of policies in place for it, and now that there seems to be there's developing momentum on this. This is a historic Tacoma policy emphasis, and Sharon's here to talk about that. So one of the things I asked Ian to do was to come here and sort of frame out for the commission sort of where the city's at currently on this. And so we're at the start, but there's momentum. We're driving towards this goal and trying to address, or identify barriers and figure out what needs to be on the work plan to address these issues. And I think that the key really here is the acceptable risk and marginal cost equation. And you know, there's a perceived barrier in marginal cost for things like seismic and fire and so forth, the separation that may or may not be there in, you know, in our land use code anticipates it, and so do our policies. That live work is something the city desires in this downtown area. The building code issue is something. Building code is very complex and can be, you know, with some discretion applied in many different ways. And so are there barriers there? So, but at this point, I think that. You know, it sounds like there's a lot of interest on the commission, so, you know, we'll figure out how to keep the commission, you know, apprised of this process and have opportunities for input, and you know, that's kind of where we're at this point. We don't have a lot beyond that to report.
If you would excuse me, there's a council meeting.
Understand. Understand. Thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you all. I'm excited to be working on this. Nice to meet you. Sharon, sorry.
Oh, it's okay. It's okay.
I want to stay active, so I need to.
And item 3B, Historic Tacoma, Sharon Winters, Board of Directors.
Thanks, good to be here. So, we're really excited to be getting some traction on this, but I have to credit the arts community for kind of starting this. They've really been working the issue for probably 8 to 10 years now, and a conversation with Jory Atkins and Rick Semple, who are kind of doing live work over on Puyallup Avenue, really kind of got me interested.
Tacoma Bike.
Yeah. Tacoma Bike, yeah. It's true. They've got a block of properties over there. We see it as a great opportunity for adaptive reuse of historic industrial and commercial buildings, getting buildings back into use that are underutilized or really vacant right now. And I think our work on the sub-area planning processes, both in the Brewery area, South Tacoma area, and up in the Hilltop, present a number of opportunities for live work. So we kind of thought the time was right, got together with Rick, and had a meeting scheduled with Peter and Ian, walked in to do our pitch, only to find that Ruben had already had a conversation with the city manager, who had had a conversation about live work, so we were kind of given the green light to kind of move forward. And so as far as timelines go, we were asked to kind of put together a group to start working on the zoning issues, and a group is going to be meeting on the 23rd. Ruben will be there, Ian will be there. We'll have a couple of board members there. AIA Southwest Washington will be represented, and Rick Semple from the developer perspective will be there. They're going to start knocking through the zoning, and as Ian said, Ian and Charlie Salverson are working on the building code issues. Timelines, we're hoping to have a proposal on the zoning changes by June 30th and building code changes by the end of the year. So we're optimistic that we're actually going to get this to happen. You've got our white paper, which really comes, the basis for it really comes from a lot of research that Rick and Jory have done over the years. You've also got some links to some really good work that has been done by other cities. Ian really wanted a Washington State example just because of the codes, and Seattle, as Mark has pointed out, they're already doing it. There's a number of other cities around the country that are, and Rick continues to gather that information so that we're not recreating the wheel. We're really trying to create something that, learn from what others have done, but make it right for Tacoma. But there are a number of opportunities. And I think that in going to one of the focus group sessions for the South Downtown area work, the consultants have their heads around the live-work concept, see some real opportunities in South Downtown. So I'm hoping we've really got a good moment here to really not only implement some changes in our ordinance, but actually do it really soon. I'm hoping to work with the Arts Commission. I see some opportunities in the fall with the Art at Work month, where we might be close enough to actually having something in place where, with the studio tours, we might be able to actually do something and give people a way to kind of look at what this might look like. So that would be cool. I've broached that topic with Amy. We haven't really talked in detail about it. So we've got good energy on it. We're excited about the potential. So questions that y'all might have or things that we need to be attentive to as we move forward.
Pardon me.
Go ahead.
it's always been my opinion, though I'd love to see it in downtown, and I know why the city wants to do it in downtown. I always thought there were areas around the city where it was equally, if not more, justified. Say, South Tacoma, along South Tacoma Way, or along Washington, or even in the Nalley Valley area, even though it's industrial.
Mm-hmm. I don't see it as just a downtown thing.
I don't either. That's why I always thought that the city was trying too hard to force it into downtown, and the way the real estate market works, it was not necessarily a compatible fit.
Right, right. Well, especially given our work in South Tacoma last year, we know those buildings pretty well, and there are. I mean, it's the shop house concept of, you know, you've got the shop on the ground floor, you've got the residents upstairs, and I know in talking with Peter Huffman before we started that project, you know, it's hard for property owners in that area to do the full thing at one time as far as upgrading those buildings. There needs to be a way to think creatively about how to bring those buildings up to code kind of over time to kind of get those buildings back into use, get them back in the tax rolls. Over time, so the property owners are not overextending themselves.
I think one thing that the city is going to be looking for from the community is things that make appropriate sort of like case reviews or case studies for where we might have code issues that have occurred either because somebody was trying to do a project like Rick and Jory, they encountered barriers or some uncertainty. Or they had problems financing a project because of the uncertainty of the application of the code, or where their properties seem like they'd be ideal, but for whatever reason, they're not attractive because of a perceived...
The way to get around that and a good selling point is to have like a white paper that lays out the code issues and the give and take for zoning and code issues. Like how, you know, what's the probability, you know, like we know anything with an R occupancy that has to be upgraded for seismic. It just goes without saying. And going in, most developers know that already going in.
Well, my understanding, and Rick and Jory have looked at this, Rick is sort of doing what you're talking about
right now. Yeah.
But apparently, because this would apply just to older buildings, and if you cut it off at 1975, that's when the seismic stuff kicks in. And so if you say that's what other cities have done. If you say pre-1975, apparently you don't, correct me if I'm wrong here, you don't have to do all the seismic.
There's less, okay.
Yeah.
It depends on building types. It depends on age of those building types. Certain buildings.
Okay.
Certain buildings in 75 would have been fine. Fine now. Other types would not necessarily.
Okay.
But yeah, that was the early 70s were kind of the introduction of modern seismic code.
Yeah.
Even though it's developed a great deal since then.
We had, I remember having this discussion with Blaine Johnson, and this was about 8 years ago, about he would like to do this, but because of the building and the building stock that he was being funneled to, he would have to spend most of his construction budget just bringing it up to seismic code for residential.
I think one of our issues that at least has been perceived too is that in the past, you know, there have been projects that have been permitted and been fine that may not have been permitted at a different time or, you know, under different circumstances just because of the way the building code was applied or the arguments that an applicant might have made or how that was received by staff. And one of the things that, from a sort of a city policy perspective, we also want to make sure is that there's sort of a clear, more predictable bright line, you know, for some of these things. I know that these get to be complicated projects or they require some discretion, but if there is, like, this perception or if we're going into weird spots in the code and making calls that aren't consistently made or, you know, in some cases, you know, trying to resolve those issues too. And so I guess when I say, like, working through the different scenarios or different cases, for instance, just even knowing, like, what the experience of individuals in the community, maybe not large developers, but more small-scale property owners even, just to see where they've perceived or encountered actual barriers would be very helpful, I think, to the team.
Yeah, I think coming back to what I think the easiest way to do it, if it's already a B occupancy, if the building's already B occupancy, maybe the way around the code is to just make residential an accessory use, like a back office, is the easiest way around the code.
Yeah, you short circuit a lot of that.
Right.
If you can get that change of use.
If it's a new...
Change of use in the occupancy, the code occupancy, right, out of the way, then you streamline a lot of that. And going from a B to an R occupancy makes the basic assumption that you're going to go from X number of occupants per square foot for X number of hours a day to,
right,
a different level, which is a higher level, or a perception of a higher level. But it seems to me in a work, live, work environment, your occupants per square foot should reasonably be less than any other R occupancy, but would perhaps be more than kind of a given B occupancy. So there's got to be a middle ground in there. If you're gonna really look to put this in on a code level, I think you almost need to address it in the code and create that occupancy, kind of a sub-occupancy.
I think Dan had a question.
Yeah, this might be a stupid question, but have some of these code issues been addressed in how the city approached the SpaceWorks program and working with Shunpike and some of those commercial spaces that have been used for non-commercial purposes for our installations?
I don't know that.
I don't know either. I
can
know.
Ask Amy.
He's asking you?
I can ask Amy.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
Because that might be something worth looking into, because I'm sure
the storefront spaces around town that ArtSpace has taken over. Yeah.
Yeah, because they've had to work with multiple individual owners to coordinate that. And I imagine similar issues to this have come up.
But I think that's probably less of an occupancy change issue.
Oh,
because it's still being used,
yeah,
as,
right,
a commercial space. It's just,
yeah,
a display space versus kind of an actual business storefront. So I think there's just, it's that fine wrinkle in the code that if you get that.
And
that shift in that occupancy, or you know, as his white paper says, that there's you know, I think it's that San Francisco uses like a 75% of code force upgrade, kind of as an intermediate step to a full upgrade, because you're not going to go to a full R risk category in these occupancies, you just wouldn't. And so there may be a good way to get kind of an intermediate step. And there's, you know, we've worked with the city on historic renovations and renovations of old buildings time and again, and there's sort of a list of things that you start at the top of the list, and they're the most risky as far as seismically speaking. You know, and URM buildings are the classic example of parapets and anchorage and things like that. And so if you can address some of those things, you can create kind of a hierarchy. And a lot of times when buildings don't hit the triggers, but owners still want to do something, we kind of set up those priority lists of, well, you attack this first, you attack that next,
yeah,
and you spend your dollars where you can.
That acceptable,
right,
risk level.
Yeah, you try and chase
before you can move on.
Yeah, you try and chase the weak link of the building down to,
sure,
to less and less risk.
Well,
you take the risk
like
pieces first.
It seems like on that, you sort of want to create a B2. You know, there's a standard B occupancy, and then why not a B2, which allows for the accessory use.
Yeah, X number of square feet.
Yeah, that makes the most sense.
Yeah.
And that way, say you wanted to put it in manufacturing occupancy, then you're not increasing the amount of risk in the...
Well, it's like an A occupancy being accessory to a B.
Right,
like if you have a restaurant that has a small seating area, that as long as that A space is small enough relative to the B space,
it doesn't.
I dealt with it up in Redmond a year and a half ago, and it was, if you can keep that square, and I think you can limit that, as long as you don't get your R square footages don't become too large, then you don't actually get into an R occupancy. So
yeah, mine.
I think there's actually some pretty easy ways to take care of this. It's just a matter of how you write it.
And I think that's one of the things in the white paper was talking about, the accessory.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty easy code language put together to take care of those.
And since Tacoma has its own overlay over the building code, that could be injected fairly easily.
Well, and most cities are using the same code set, you know, the same basis, the IBC or the IBC or AEBC.
Yeah, it's all ICC.
And so yeah, everybody's using those now. So the and each jurisdiction is adopted, especially as I guess as long as they're in Washington State, there should be relatively, you know, similar language for those. And so.
Yeah, but every jurisdiction has their own set of amendments.
Well, Seattle Building Code.
Exactly.
Yeah, I know.
Well, the Seattle Building Code is the ICC plus these 50 pages of stuff.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. Any other questions, comments, suggestions?
I have a question for Ruben, and maybe a larger group. I've been trying to keep Amy in the loop.
Mm-hmm.
Does somebody from the arts community need to be at that zoning conversation? You know, I view Rick as being pretty tuned into the arts community.
I mean, I think is Amy on that? Has she been contacted on that workshop?
On that conversation about zoning, no.
Okay. I mean, I would consider contacting her and just asking her if she's interested or arts commission is. I mean, because I think it's nice. I think that they're some of the critical users.
Right, I agree.
And so, I mean, as long as you're working through some of the different issues and trying to identify them, I mean,
okay,
that'd probably be helpful. But,
okay. I'll ask her because I asked to actually get a slot for the arts commission and she kind of demurred on that because I think they've been disappointed a lot because they've gotten their hopes up about this several times and then nothing ever happened. So I think she wanted to wait further in the process to make sure that this is actually going to happen. So maybe I'll contact her and see if she wants to come. I viewed it as sort of a policy nerd meeting. I'm not going to go because I'm not going to let us. I'm going to let the folks
zoning
who live and breathe that stuff every day work through the zoning stuff. But okay, good. Well, thanks for your time. I appreciate it. Well, Ruben will keep you posted.
Thank you. That concludes. Pardon me? That concludes item 3A and B. Item 4, chair comments. I have none at this time. Item 5 is board business. Item A, preservation month. Category I, selection of preservation. Annual awards and activities, final review. I never did get anything from you or anyone else as far as review for, like, yeah.
Okay.
So maybe, well, at this time, maybe it's
that's
next
stage
year,
stage.
I don't know. Okay, we've been through that. Okay. So far, what we have discussed, and Commissioner Eckley's not here. He said he was going to be late, but it looks like it's going to be later than late. We came upon the idea of local historians and their contributions. David Jepson, Ron Magden, Winifred Olson, Carolyn Galacci, and Tom Stanger were the I subsequently, after a comment in the last meeting, asked three of the leading sort of renovation contractors, which Michael Fast was one of them, and Duke and Abel, if they had any projects that they would like to submit, and I've not heard anything back. Duke was the only person that even bothered to respond.
I got a great project that we just had a photographer out there 2 weeks ago that took a lot of pictures of.
Okay.
Of it. It's a historic registered home that we did a three-story addition on the back of. And I apologize. I thought Stacy had put it all together and we had it down here. But we got to it busy at least.
Could we hold off for another 2 weeks making a decision?
Tony might have your head.
I'll say fine, sure. You know?
I've learned not to get on Tony's bed. So
do we have another meeting in April?
We'll have a meeting on the 25th.
On the 25th, but that's awfully late. Yeah.
Well, the other thing is that, I mean, one thing that the commission traditionally does is this annual address to council with a proclamation that typically does the awards at city council. I mean, we don't have to do those all at once, or do them this year. Even I think it's nice to keep the city council presentation intact. I mean, at least as far as addressing.
Well, I believe that I was discussing with Ed Eckley the one night we came up with this idea. Nothing says we have to give out awards.
No, I mean recognition for achievement is one of the things that commissions do in certified local governments. At the same time, I think that how you do that there's lots of ways to do it. One thing that's kind of occurred to me over the past several years is it might be something for the commission to sort of just consider, how an awards and recognition program works from year to year. It's always been kind of loose and so forth. And it might be worthwhile to consider, like we talked about. We did talk about like residential contractors, that specific line of projects and self nomination or people nominating to the commission certain projects and that kind of thing, and then having the commission select from people that have actually solicited an award in a way. It takes some of the work off of you guys, I think, from trying to generate that list, but there's nothing that says that you have to do it this year. I do think that I'm putting together an address to city council sort of explains what the what's happened over the last year, some of the great things, some of the challenges, some of the learnings, that sort of thing. I think is a really important thing to do, especially because councils change and so other than that though, and I think that part's really easy in a way.
Right, and I like doing it actually, so it's not a.
So
I could nominate one of you to do it if you want. What is your pleasure? Do you feel like giving awards this year? Or do you want to, is this group of historians or one or two of these historians you would like to? It's sort of like pulling it out of the hat. Since they've not come before this board, it's pretty hard to really, it sounds like it's ad hoc. In a sense,
I mean one thing that what I would like an example I would throw out is say later on in the year this Landmarks Commission announces and we put it on Facebook and we put it on our mailing list and we send a press release out saying that the Landmarks Commission is seeking a award or people or projects for recognition in these four categories. And then just let that sit there for a few months or a couple months, and then see what you get towards the end of the year, and have that be one of the things you do either at the end of the year or the very start of the next year.
Right.
And that way, you're also not surprising people that have suddenly found out that they've earned an award for.
Yeah, exactly, and that's what I'm afraid of in this whole instance.
And because in that way also you've removed some of the pressure on the timeline, because. At this point, we're trying to identify people and then find out if they're interested in that and then schedule before council. So,
well, that's what I was trying to pre-priming. That's why I was getting in touch with Duke and Abel and Michael Fass saying, do you have projects that you could put forward?
Has anybody talked about the Foremost Building project?
I don't think it was never landmarked, unfortunately.
Oh, it wasn't? Okay.
And Michael Barrett, is that right? I've done work for him. I did work. He owns the, what was the Schoenfelds building, and several other buildings around town. The building that BCRA is in, he owns that building, and the one directly next to it, and it worked.
Bartlett.
That's it. Thank you, Michael Bartlett.
Bartlett.
With Horizon Partners.
I think he sold the Foremost Building.
Did he sell the Foremost Building?
It's because it's an American investment or something.
Yeah, American Family Investments.
Yeah.
Well, I remember
American Life.
That's it.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I remember Elizabeth Anderson after Michael Bartlett did get that on the register, and it never happened, particularly because it had, though reserved, some fairly nice Art Deco detailing on it and a nice, you know, industrial steel sash windows, which are all now gone. So I think the fabric's gone for the foremost building for the most part.
I can report, I mean, just in case anybody's interested, that actually went through the American Life, did the project on it, and they brought in the Social Security Administration, I think, is their anchor tenant, and they were already underway on project construction, but unfortunately, bringing in the Social Security Administration triggered a Section 106 review that they weren't anticipating, and the architectural plans, which proceeded as they had planned, were determined to be an adverse effect on the building. And so there is a historic interpretive package sign being installed, or has been installed in there. That was an issue that that I was dealing with early last year. I mean, that building was vacant for a very, very long time. But I think that, by the same token, it's one of probably the few significant commercial projects outside of public sector that we've seen in Tacoma.
It's fully occupied, or scheduled to be fully occupied, at least from my understanding, which is why it popped up on my radar.
Yeah. I've always liked that building. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, I was going to say, if we do the kind of thing that Rune was suggesting about asking for nominations from the broader public, maybe one of the categories might be buildings that are not registered, you know, and so forth, but have been renovated in some respect, you know, and so forth. So to perhaps be able to acknowledge some of these that might qualify for some kind of attention, perhaps.
Yeah, that aren't registered, but made a good try at doing something proper.
I like the idea of annual awards, but I think the timeline and the idea of getting some nominations from the public, or just making it an option, sounds great.
My two cents on it, I guess, is if you're struggling to find somebody to give an award to, maybe you shouldn't give an award.
Yeah, that's kind of mine too.
If there's something that jumps out and you say, yeah, that's really deserving of an award, an award's an award. It's not an entitlement. Nobody's entitled to this award. If there's not something that we deem worthy of an award, then...
I also think there isn't a huge interest, but I think you probably develop interest in it. And I think that people sort of soliciting or promoting their own projects would make the commission aware of things they may not be aware of right now.
Yeah, and I love that idea. And a lot of other organizations handle things very much that same. I mean, AIA is a self-nomination for design awards. And
that's right.
Many other organizations in the building industry are self-nominated for awards.
We could have a category of Landmarks Commissioner of the Year.
I know.
You got a pretty good chance. You know, pretty good shot. So,
yeah, as long as the parameters are defined, you don't waste a lot of time in the review process. And
right.
Yeah.
And it would be pretty. I mean, it'd be really discretionary for the commission. You get these things in and see if any of them rise.
Well, particularly because next year we've got some educational projects coming. I mean, we've got Washington Hoyt that at least will be in the design. You're not out the door until October, though.
Yeah, it's just starting schematic this summer.
Okay.
I think it's scheduled to hit the street for bidding next spring, this time of next year.
Yeah, that's what I thought, too, if I remember that.
But it'll be that'll be a year and a half construction.
That's a year and a half. That's a couple of years out, then.
Murray Markham will be online.
There was some blurb in one of the local blogs that it's already the favorite project of most of, you know, of those Tacomans reading it. So,
reading that particular blog,
yeah. Okay, it sounds.
Excuse me. I was just going to say I'm going to go ahead and submit this project, and if we decide to move beyond, then it'll be here for next year if we decide to.
Well, that's, you know, it's like I said in my email, even though if it's within the last couple years, if it was completed, you know, we
We'll backdate you, as you know.
Well, that's, I mean, like, yeah, I mean, you probably know what the criteria for, like, an AIA award. I mean, it's within, it's completion within, like, the last
two years
or something.
Correct,
like that,
yeah.
Too. So, I mean, because, you know, people get in a hurry to get their project done, and they don't spend a lot of time wanting to nominate it. In
right.
The 2 or 3 months that they're taking the breath after they've gone through this effort of getting it complete.
Well, I'm
too,
willing,
so,
you know, I'm willing to go through. We can solicit from the AGC, we can, you know, from the master builders, from the AIA, and any other sort of professional.
From developers. And
developers
and whoever
else.
I mean,
right.
Yeah.
I like the idea of just having more attention to it, more press too, like actually
yeah.
approaching the different communities and putting it in social networking or something, that it would actually become
this is Chairman,
ideally
a coveted
award.
In.
Yeah.
Yeah, instead of just us picking names out of a hat.
Well,
exactly.
And I think I don't think you have to spend a lot of time. I mean, if you get, you know, 15 or 20 submissions and people submit, you know, a couple 8.5 by 11s or, you know, whatever, I mean, you can look through those things pretty quickly and give it the old sniff test of what really kind of stands up and what doesn't.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you don't have to spend a tremendous amount of time with it, and before you can narrow it down to kind of, you know, half a dozen that we can all look at together to.
Well, we don't.
That perspective.
It sounds like there's consensus. So
I was hoping we would get there. So I'm doing my best.
The one other thing was just the chair's address, the annual report to City Council, and typically it's the by the numbers approach to start with, kind of just saying what actually happened.
I've done 3 of them. So
dollar amounts and things
yeah.
like that. Maybe some of the notable things. I mean, there's some good things, such as the, Clay Huntington Way, actually, that name change actually was a really nice process that we went through. The economic downturn challenges, some of the things that the commission's resolved over the past, there have been some big deals, like the house on 4th Street, that's more or less resolved. Maybe we don't have to bring that up or not. But
you might not want to.
You know, Murray Morgan Bridge, Wedge Neighborhood Historic District, that sort of thing. And so if that's the right approach, I mean, then Tony and me would cobble together sort of a highlights, you know, list to select from or and kind of meld into whatever you want it to be. And then when we settle on that date, we put in a proclamation presentation request.
Okay. Is there anything that any commissioner would like to see included in the annual report? And if you can't think of it, if it hits you, you know, in a couple days, please email Ruben.
Maybe some mention of the, if it's relevant, the arson of the structure at Point Defiance. And
oh, yeah.
That would be a good one.
Go to.
Yeah, go to building.
Yeah, go to. Thank you. For some reason, I have the word gazebo in my head.
It seems
a really nice gazebo.
Really nice gazebo.
And actually, I mean, if anybody's been down there recently, they're doing an outstanding job on that project.
I have not seen that yet.
The damage on it was absolutely horrific.
Yeah, we saw the photos when Melissa came in.
And so, yeah, I walked through about maybe 2 months ago, you see the roofing guys up there doing curved roofs.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a career roofing job.
Right, in tile.
Yeah.
You know, that's the interesting part, yeah.
And so they're enjoying it, although I don't think some of them will admit it. So
it'll be good. It'll be good that it gets a little bit of sprucing up, too.
Talking to Metro Parks about that work, apparently there was some of the Never Neverland molds and original figurines were stored in that building and were partially damaged during that fire as well.
Probably water damage down in the basement.
Yeah.
Tremendous amount of smoke damage in there, too.
Yeah.
So, and the building now, of course, is seismically sound. There's lots of other little code issues that have been taken care of at the same time, so... The loss of fabric was really great. I mean, one of the big things was the sheeting on the roof that were these tongue and groove, like, big old planks that shrunk after. They're 100 years old, and they shrunk by, like, 10% or something.
Yeah, 3x6 or 3x8.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, at any rate, though, but that's, I think that's a really a good suggestion. So anything, if anybody has any ideas or things to include,
I would even think of where would you like to see the commission go? What would you like us to be working on in the future? All right.
Well, there's design guidelines, which we've got listed, and hopefully we'll be working on that soon rather than later. Seeing as how it's now, 4 months into the new year?
The rewrite of the design guidelines for Wedge and North Slope.
Yep.
Yeah.
I think we were supposed to be working on that last year at the...
We were, and then we had a... we didn't have a high level of interest, and so because of scheduling issues and trying to get that in place, we bumped it into the next year. So.
And then the other area is any code revisions, and the two that I worry about the most, if there's anything that keeps me awake at night, but I mean, I'm exaggerating if I say that. One is that I think the delisting procedure that we've got needs to be tightened up considerably because, I mean, to me, the way it's written right now, we would not have the Elks building today if we had that in the code. I mean, I might be wrong about that, but I mean, it just seems like a huge, huge problem that we've got now.
I thought delisting was only at the discretion of the Landmarks Commission.
Well, but it seems like the procedure that we have in place and the kinds of arguments that are allowed, that seem to be allowed to be made. Now, it is at the discretion of LPC, but nonetheless, the fact that that we kind of open up that can of worms. In the past, we separated, the commission separated the idea of placing a building on the register as a historic landmark from the process of, let's say, maintaining that building.
So, we've had this discussion in years past that we have the problem of neglect necessitating delisting.
Sure.
And, pardon me.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
That's something that this commission has discussed for at least 10 years.
Well, and now we've got a procedure in place that's in the code that essentially allows a property owner to come and say, I want to have my property delisted as a landmark because I'm in a financial bind and I can't maintain the property. Now, that's not to say that the commission shouldn't deal with those kinds of issues. It does. But it's not, to me, it's once you've been named a landmark, you're a landmark. And your financial situation doesn't change the fact that the building is a landmark. It may change what is allowed to be done with the landmark, but it doesn't make it not a landmark. It's still a landmark.
And, you know, and this is one of those things that, I mean, the reason why that particular section of the code is in the code was in, God, I don't know how many years ago it was, but at any rate, there was a, when we started doing the preservation plan, it was a direct instruction from the city council to put that in. And there was not a plan to have a delisting procedure articulated because it didn't seem really necessary. The city council at its discretion can delist something anytime they want via resolution, whether or not the Landmarks Commission agrees or not. That's within the city council's authority already. And so there was a request that a procedure be articulated. And so, you know, trying to create criteria, but at the same time make those criteria tight and clean enough, you know, that it makes sense, and that there is a path by which this can be done, but also that the commission doesn't have to do it. I mean, but I agree. I mean, I agree with that. There's issues there with it.
So that's one. And the other one is the tightening up the economic hardship piece that's in the code. That's again seems to be pretty loose in terms of how we interpret that.
And specific criteria for demonstration of hardship, I think, is what you're getting at.
Exactly.
I part of the thing there too, there was this idea that with the economic hardship side that there would be certain things the commission wouldn't call economic hardship but would have as alternative approaches to certain sorts of design problems and things like that that would reside within design guidelines, as opposed to be codified as a part as an economic hardship. Now the design guidelines piece hasn't been shored up yet, but the economic hardship, I think that it would probably be, we don't have a code update scheduled at this time, although I'm sure we'll be back there in a year or two. But having specific instances where language, like, you know, if anybody does have any ideas about how the language should change or the meaning should shift or the relationship between different things should shift, I think just, marking it up and sending it in it works too.
That's fine. But anyway, those were two sort of code update issues that I thought were bothering me. Maybe nobody else.
Well, in the appointment of the ex officio. That bothers you too. And it bothers me.
Okay. I think we've come to the end of our discussion. I will open up the floor to anyone for announcements, comments, or shameless plugs. Hearing none, we are adjourned. Yeah, I have a little A restaurant going into an old B, but it's too large. It's just...